So this is James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a town and spend a year there doing business and making money. Yet you do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wishes, we'll live, and we'll do this and that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Anyone, then, who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it commits sin. And then chapter 5, verses 7 through 11. Be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious crop from the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also must be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Beloved, do not grumble against one another, that you may not be judged. See, the judge is standing at the doors. As an example of suffering and patience, beloved, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we call blessed those who showed endurance. You have heard of the endurance of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. And Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing to you. So, in today's message, I'll be talking about, in order, the weather, fruit, young people, and gravel paths. All very important topics. First off, the weather. I'm told that every good, stimulating conversation should include a discussion of the weather, right? This message is going to have a lot of discussion of the weather. Buckle up. My dad studied some meteorology when he was in college, and it didn't end up being his career. But a classic pastime when I was young was switching to the Weather Channel, specifically if the clock had an 8 on it, for the local on the 8s, which is when they switch the national Weather Channel coverage to your local channel at 618, 628, etc. And you get to see the Doppler radar charts. And my dad and me, we'd stand close to the TV, sort of squinting at it, and he'd be squinting at it, I'd be sort of squinting at him, squinting at it. And I pretend I understood what the barometric lines meant, and still don't really know what those mean. But because of that, I love the weather. I love checking on it. I love looking ahead, planning my days, comparing temperatures in different parts of the world, particularly when it's as hot as it is around here. I just love knowing it, most of all. I love being the first person to chime in when someone says, oh, I heard it's supposed to rain next week. And then I get to say, yeah, I think it's supposed to hit overnight on Wednesday going into Thursday. That should probably clear out the low pressure system we've been dealing with, start dropping temperatures down so that we start seeing highs in the mid-70s, get some nice bedtime temps in upper 60s or something like that. I just love knowing. Maybe it's because the Bible cares so much about the weather and how unpredictable it is, and it's nice not having to suffer like people did then in uncertainty. I've noticed that in the Bible, the weather that comes is usually attributed to the Lord completely. It's just an expression of his feelings and how he'd like to act in the world. It's reactive and explosive. From Jeremiah, for example, when he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he makes the mist rise from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain, and he brings forth the wind from his storehouses. And in Jonah, but the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so the ship threatened to break up. It's all credited to the Lord. He controls the weather, and it uses it to accomplish his purposes. It's funny then to me that when you see in other parts of the Bible, the things that grow as a result of that weather, the crops and the trees, they're seen as cyclical and consistent. It's one thing that caught my eye in that Job passage there, verses 7 through 9, which we just read. For there is hope for a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its shoots will not cease, though its root grow old in the earth, and its stump die in the soil, yet at the scent of water it will bud and put out branches like a young plant. I mean, the Lord, after all, he does give a promise about harvest and regrowth to Noah after the ark. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. He promises that that cycle will continue. So Scripture often worries about the weather and what the Lord might bring, but it believes that there will always be a cycle of return for the things that the weather affects, specifically the natural world. And I think that that view comes from the fact that this time and culture was completely dominated by farming. So right now in America, about 2% of the population are farmers. Try to imagine how differently we think about the world if, like in any time prior to about the 1700s, about 90% of the world were farmers. Imagine if 9 out of 10 people in this room had strong opinions on seeding strategies, harvesting methods for stone fruits, subscribed to Tractors Monthly. 9 out of 10 people in this room. That's the audience to the Bible. There are stories about how missionaries to indigenous people in South America, for example, when translating the Gospels, had to come up with a different word to mean sheep, because the concept of a four-legged creature whose hairy back could make clothing for you magically just didn't make sense to those people, and so they had to change that. So to a great extent, we are effectively the same as those indigenous people in our potential misunderstanding of any time the Bible offers a metaphor on harvest or crops or fruit or caring for animals or growing things. Maybe we need to be careful in how we think about the fruits of the Spirit, for example. Careful to think of those things as something that is laboriously, back-breakingly cultivated with sweat and uncertainty as to how it will turn out, instead of something that can be purchased at the store by exchanging something of equal value. That farmer worldview is sort of core to what I'm talking about today, and it reshapes much of how we understand the Bible. In more than just what I'm talking about today. And one thing that I want to focus on is that the concept of growing a crop is a balance of uncertainty, faith, and action. I'll say that again. An important farmer lesson is that growing a crop involves a delicate balance of uncertainty, faith, and action. We'll get back to that in a minute, because I promised that after talking about fruit, I'd mention young people. Ah, young people. So culture has a lot of fun talking about the generations. Boomers, Gen X, Millennials, Gen Z. I don't put too much stock into it. I think it's fun to consider sort of like personality types, the Enneagram, that sort of thing. And so the length of years between generations is like 15 to 18, and so boomers, mid-40s, early 60s, Gen X, mid-60s, early 80s, millennials, early 80s, mid-90s, Gen Z, mid-90s, early 2010s. Taylor and I have younger siblings in Gen Z, and they're just hitting the workforce. And I thought a little bit about the major forces in our culture that have shaped them as they come of age, and the same major forces that are affecting the rest of us as well. I've wanted to, for a while, to just take some time and like almost like write an essay about this, and I thought about calling it the Age of Wonder, so-called, because we don't really have to wonder anymore in this time. You know, what's the capital of Madagascar? Antananarivo. Hey phone, how long should this rice cook for? Is some person I saw in the news a bad person? We can look up anything we want and get an answer, wrong or right, instantly. The obvious risk of this is that we lose the ability to perceive what's true and what's trusted, and we mistake knowledge for wisdom. And it's only accelerating as AI delivers knowledge to us faster, packaged more elegantly as wisdom. But more importantly, today in our culture, we hate uncertainty. I hate it. It's part of the reason I constantly check the weather on my phone. I love knowing. I love being able to know. I need to watch how things are going politically. I need the precise measurements for the recipe. I want to watch the prices of things I want to buy. I think maybe I'm particularly susceptible to this crap because I work as an analyst and I'm paid essentially to know things and find out the right answer to questions. And this is a generalization that's certainly not true of all young people, but one difference between the people in this room, the generations, older generations, and young people writ large, again, a generalization, is that while previous generations might enjoy being able to look up things, I think that a younger person today generally has a dependence on the connection to ready answers. It's one feature of having constant access to a cell phone. It doesn't frustrate young people to not know the answer. It worries them. It scares them. Taylor and I experienced this a little bit when we led a group of young folks to Iceland, and they weren't able to have their phones for a bit. To not have their phone means they can't know the directions to a destination. Gen Z spends on average 10 hours online each day because connection represents stability. Disconnection represents instability, the unknown, not being able to look it up. I'm just old enough to be in that generation before, to remember a time before the internet when I'd, as a child, ponder about a question, ask my parents, wonder about things. Why this? Why that? And sometimes I'd even check an encyclopedia for an answer. Sometimes I just wouldn't know the answer and I'd have to live with that. And that was fine, because some things just aren't readily knowable. We forget that. Farmers know this. They know that summer and winter will come, day and night, a time to plant, a time to sow. But they don't know how much there will be to reap at the end, whether it will be a good harvest or bad. This was Job's argument with God, not knowing. Job is wonderful to me because it's our oldest story written chronologically. It's one of the oldest stories that we have in our culture at all. Remember from the passage, he was starting by facing uncertainty overall in the book of Job with confidence and trust. He defends his case with, he believes that he has a good relationship with God from the passage we read. He's aware that man dies, but he considers the promise of the sprout that comes back up from the stump. And so this is from what we just read. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my renewal would come. You would call, and I would answer you. You would long for the work of your hands. For then you would number my steps. You would not keep watch over my sin. My transgression would be sealed up in a bag, and you would cover over my iniquity. This was Job's position in the middle of his story. He starts off well, believing in the possibility of redemption. But then, as you might remember from the book, his friends start leading him astray, losing trust at the order of it all, at the uncertainty of life. He, at the end of the story, stops trusting, starts questioning. And he starts posing questions to God, and that when God finally answers him, he responds with these thundering, beautiful words. This is one of my favorite passages in Scripture, Job 38, right at the end. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. In short, you question the order of things, you have questions, how would you know? And eventually Job says, you're right. How could I understand all these complicated things? When we are confronted with uncertainty, with unknowns, the unknowable, one of our poor first responses can be to pretend to understand or to get frustrated. That isn't the right response. Let's look at James instead. So James says from this other passage that we just read, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. So again, we have the metaphor of the farmer. Because of this, to this audience, they get it. The audience to this this story was deeply familiar with the uncertainty of seeding a crop and waiting, hoping for a result. Now, continuing back with James. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. James is trying to get the message across that uncertainty is normal and results take time, just like a crop does. That ultimately, like in Job's case, the Lord is good. Now, there's some nuance here. So Taylor and I were at a summer camp the week before last, and we were telling the story of Job to the kids as part of one of our lessons, and how he loses everything, trusts in the Lord, and gets everything back. And those wise kids, the first question that they asked after that is, does that mean that God will always fix the bad things that happen to us? And of course, you have to be honest with the kids and with yourself and say, no, it doesn't mean that he's going to fix it every time. And James doesn't say that either. He doesn't say, be patient in your suffering, because I guarantee you that your suffering will end tomorrow, and if you've lost something, you will get it back. He doesn't say that. He doesn't promise perfect, immediate, balanced fairness. What he points to is that the Lord in all capital letters, who is in charge of the universe, is compassionate and merciful and good. He says that perseverance is key, and the response to suffering is patience. That's a fine balance that I think is sometimes lost on us because we're not farmers. Farmers have lean years and rich years. They have droughts that might go on and might end suddenly. They have no reason to think that life would be perfectly understandable, exactly measurable, instantly Googleable. They know that it's cyclical, that there will be winter, there will be summer, someday rain, someday sun. They dwell in uncertainty held within faith. And balancing the two things is a profound wisdom. So I studied physics in college, doing my best to understand the foundations of the world, to peer into those unknowable things. One of the favorite things that I learned as a physicist was that even though we've gotten better at understanding weather, there's a fundamental limit. We've had thousands of years to study the weather, to improve. Starting with, we issued forecasts in the 1800s. We started using computers and radar so that we're better at predicting it than we were before. But no matter what we do, no matter what satellites and computational models, quantum computing, AI, whatever, we have no idea what the weather will be like more than 2 weeks out. It's this fundamental limit where the complexity gets staggering and nothing we do penetrates that outer limit. We're more than 14 days, we can't predict the difference between a hurricane and a sunny day. It's the butterfly effect, right? When a butterfly flaps its wings in Vermont, a tornado happens in Kansas. Basically, no matter how smart we get, our world is beautiful and complicated enough that human reasoning can only get us so far, and we can't know the future 2 weeks out. We aren't really any better at it now than we were when there were horses on our streets. It's incredibly humbling to realize that, and again, farmers could have told us. James and Job tell us that we can't know what the weather will be. God will just do what he does. There's day and night, and winter and summer, and a time to plant, a time to sow. And hidden in there, I think, is the response that we're supposed to have to uncertainty. It's in Jesus' parables too, half of which have to do with farming, animals, or plants. I think actually you can find the answer pretty clearly in the parable of the talents, which isn't on its face clearly about anything that we've been talking about. That one was always tricky for me, because you have to remember that a talent doesn't mean a gift, it means a unit of money, and that on its face it almost looks like a parable about investment advice. The man, remember, gives his servants some money, and two of them use the money, earn a return, and give the money plus interest back to their lord. But then the one servant says, and here's the KJV version, which I like to use for the obscure parts of the Bible, the tricky ones, that I always read in my head with a British accent. Then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I know thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. And then his Lord rebukes him for not using the talent, growing it, returning it with interest. And he throws him into the outer darkness. It's tricky when you think of that story as just about money. It's easier when you think of it, for example, as seed. That servant is the farmer who fears the weather, doesn't plant, because he knows that God is capricious and might wither his crops or send him a flood or a hurricane. So he keeps his seed in a box and he doesn't use it. It's not what seed's for. If you do that, it'll spoil, won't grow more seed, won't feed anyone. Yes, there might be lean years, there might be hard years, but you still have to sow. You still have to plant. The only sure way to not have any food is to not plant at all. When we, the people in this room, consider uncertain times, our response to uncertainty must be, first, allow ourselves to sit in that uncertainty uncomfortably if necessary, because there are unknowable things in this world. Second, to hold that discomfort in a framework of faith, because not everything is fair, but we believe that the God of this universe is merciful and compassionate. And three, to act, to plant. Because we must live, we must act, we must sow, even in uncertainty, especially in uncertainty, because the alternative is to squander any opportunities that we've been given. The balance of uncertainty, faith, action. To be abundantly clear, I've been thinking about this as Taylor and I prepare for our move to Scotland. There's much uncertainty and a lot of stress for the things that we can't figure out yet, but we believe that we're on the right path and we have to keep walking forward. And I believe that this is also a message for anyone, including especially our church. We've lived the last 3-4 years in uncertainty. But we have a responsibility as bearers of the good seed, of the good news of the kingdom of God, to plant. It's our one biggest job as Christians, to share the good news with others, to plant even when we don't know the weather. Our church must take every step, any step, that leads to sharing that news with our neighbors and with our wider community, whatever they are, and must avoid at all costs any action that leads us to closing off to just eating our own seed grain. One final way to think about it, to think about dwelling in uncertainty. I was thinking about this message as I was running yesterday morning, in between bouts of rain. the weather again, right? Maybe in New England we should have a leg up on other folks about having no illusions about the predictability of weather. What's the Mark Twain joke? If you don't like the weather, wait a few minutes. Anyway, I was running on the rail trail, which connects Boxford all the way down to Peabody and Danvers. It's beautiful. It's like 11 miles or so running along the old train lines, and it's a 6-8 foot wide, well-kept gravel path that often runs dead straight for half a mile or a mile at a time. And it's lovely. Early in the morning, you see birds and deer and turtles and rabbits. And I actually was alone on the trail because of the intermittent rain, and I realized that I could actually just keep running and close my eyes, partly because the section that I was on was very straight for at least a half a mile, but more because the trail is paved in gravel and bordered by grass and trees. And every step of my sneakers, I could feel the gravel under my feet, and I knew that there was no one ahead in my way. So even over some distance, if I started to veer, I'd be able to feel 1 foot coming down on grass and just correct back to the middle and keep running, even without seeing the trail. I could run that trail at night if I wanted to, in pitch black, because it's well maintained, and I could keep feeling that feel of gravel under my feet. I think that walking forward in faith and uncertainty can be like that sometimes. Sometimes you're in the dark and there are trees and there could be curves in the path that you don't remember from when you were walking in the daytime. If there's a branch that's fallen up ahead, you might even trip over it. It might be tempting to just stop and wait for the darkness to pass, wait until you can see again, stay here for a bit. Of course, if you stop, sit down, you might get turned around, maybe even start walking back the direction that you came from. That's not why you are on the path to begin with. You're going somewhere, somewhere up ahead, and the best thing is to keep walking, slowly, if necessary. If you find you've got 1 foot in some mud, you correct, you keep walking, and you find both feet on the gravel, because you know deep down that it's a good path. It's well maintained. You trust that it's a well-maintained path, and your best option, your only option, is to keep going, keep walking, keep moving forward. That's the message that we get from these tricky stories in the Bible, from Job's humility and perseverance, from the encouragement and faith of James, from the parable of the talents, which isn't about money, really. We will face times of uncertainty. We are in uncertain times. We're in the dark. But we're on a path, and it is well maintained. We have a God who is not a tame lion, who is not safe, but he is good. And we must move forward. We must plant, exactly because we don't know, because we face things bigger than us. Wendell Berry, the poet, says the same thing in a different way. I like his take because he reminds us of the next link in the chain of logic, and this is what I'll close with. So, not only must we plant in uncertainty, that's not the final thing to remember, but also remember that it's not just about us here in the room, alive now, that get to reap. It's about future harvest, about other people. Wendell Berry, of course, phrases it better than I can, because Wendell Berry, notably, is a poet and a farmer. I'll end my rambling with his delicious words from a poem that's called The Mad Farmer's Liberation Front. Praise ignorance, for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium, plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of hummus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. I pray that this faith in growth would be an encouragement when we are caught up in uncertainty. Amen to that.